Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome to the Shogun Podcast, where the Lorehounds, your guides to the political intrigues of feudal Japan. I'm John.
And I'm Alicia, and this is our coverage for episode 3, titled Tomorrow is Tomorrow, of the FX limited series Shogun, now streaming on Hulu.
We'll be covering this episode by major character arc, talking about our favorite moments and answering listener feedback.
We have set up an email, so if you have feedback or questions, send those to shogun@thelorehounds.com. Or head to the contact page on our website and use the form or record us a voicemail that we drop right into this podcast. And also join us on our Discord. We have a fun and active community with a great mod team and special channels we have set up just for Shogun. Like overall, episode by episode, we got the Shogun works.
If you are interested in supporting the Lorehounds community, check us out on Patreon or subscribe using our new Supercast platform. Supercast is just like Patreon, but built especially for podcasters. You can get early and ad-free episodes of all our podcasts. You can also get access to the community-built online character guide. I think we're calling it the Rudder now. The show's Rudder, since that's what Blackthorn was keeping on his ship away from the Portuguese. So it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. A lot of great resources, and I've noticed a lot of people coming in for this show. So I think we are finding a new audience with people who are enjoying Shogun.
Absolutely. It seems to be one that people are picking up on, you know, by word of mouth. People saw it and they're like, I know it's quality, but there's so many shows. And now it's just the sheer volume of people saying, watch this show.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
We will have more information about supporting the community, as well as notes about our upcoming podcast schedule at the end of the podcast.
Cool. So Alicia, you're not David. Let's just address that at the front here. David will be back next week, hopefully. He's down with ye old coronavirus. So he's not feeling well. Alicia was a hero and stepped in to replace David. And maybe I'll just keep her here. You know, you never know what's going to happen next week.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about this show because it's really one of the best ones we're going to get this year.
Yeah, I mean, I saw you talking about it. I was like, I think Alicia would be a good fill-in. So I really appreciate you making the time. I know it's really late where you are. And
time is relative.
And tomorrow is tomorrow.
And tomorrow it's Japan. Japan, it's tomorrow.
So what'd you think of the episode?
Yeah, I mean, I thought this was very much a moving pieces into place episode. Like you could really see like pieces moving across a chessboard or go board or something. But by doing that, we got to see more of like the complicated web of relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I keep teasing you about Blackthorn, but actually my favorite character is Mariko. So yeah, if anything happens to her, we all riot. I think that's agreed.
I really like Mariko. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Mariko. And yeah, I'm kind of glad to be a non-reader on this one, actually. It seems like everyone I know has read the book, but I like not knowing where this is going, history spoilers aside.
I've read like the first 150 pages and then I had like an insanely busy week this week and I just couldn't read any of it. But I really like the book so far, but I'm liking the show even more. I think one of the things the show does is, one, it, you know, surprisingly, because it's 1200, it's only a single book, it's 1200 pages, but we've seen the Wheel of Time condense that enough. But the show really just keeps things moving. Like they did a very good job of dropping plot lines that didn't matter. Like, for example, we're not in the pit very long with Blackthorn's crew.
Right.
And that's like a couple chapters in the book. It's forever.
Okay.
And I just think that it's they're doing a very smart condensing of everything.
I mean, yeah, if you don't see them again after that in the book, then there's not really a reason to invest that much time in letting us get to know them.
I mean, I don't know if you do see them or not, because again, I have not gotten that far in at this point. But yeah, I just think that they're doing a really good job adapting this. I mean, as much as you rib me about Blackthorn, I do really like the character. I just think the voice, I don't like the shtick, but I do like the character. And I think other than the voice, the actor is doing a great job portraying him.
But I think that it's the beginning of a transformation for him, you know?
Okay.
That it's... That he's starting, because I was listening to him talking on the FX podcast, and he's roughing it up to be this character. And I think that he's going to, you know, we're going to see him refine in his movements, in his way of speaking as we go along. But I was saying that last time I saw him was in the latest adaptation of Jane Austen's Persuasion, and I felt he was miscast there. So this, like seeing him here, I'm like, yes, this is the character should play, because he does that puppy dog thing so well, you know, that he's this kind of charming but making a mess puppy dog to the Japanese.
That's funny, because this episode I felt like he was giving the vibe of Charlie Day going wild card, bitches.
Well, I mean, but he saved the day by doing that. Yeah.
I know. And I love that. Like, that's why this character is growing on me the more we go through this.
Yeah.
But what I'm living for in this show is the politics. And I am loving the whole council deliberation stuff, Toranaga's scheming, even Mariko. I just feel like there's something going on there that we don't know. Like, there's so many.
Oh, yeah. She's got layers.
Pressures building.
Yeah.
That make me feel like this show is going somewhere great.
Yeah. Oh, can I, though, just make one little, you guys already brought up the whole lack of Portuguese thing, but with you talking about investing in the ship characters, you know, I didn't realize until it was mentioned on the podcast. Of course, they're all Dutch except for him, but I didn't know because they were all speaking English to each other.
Right,
anyway,
right.
Okay, I'm done bitching about the language.
Yeah. He's just the rogue Englishman. Well, I'm really liking the show. It sounds like you are, too. Shall we get into some of the main plots, because I think that'll be a better way for us to center ourselves in this show.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So I want to sort of talk about the different characters and what they go through here. So we've got Yabushige.
Mm-hmm.
And what an interesting character that I can't read at all. You know, he starts off writing a will, whereas like last episode, he felt like he thought he was hot shit.
Right.
And this episode, he was ready to die.
But I can't tell if he's immoral or not, or I guess my definition, what is my definition of morality? Because that's probably irrelevant to him.
I do think he is, I don't want to diagnose him, but it sounds like he lacks empathy, right? Like he's
I think there's a lot
torturing
of jealousy.
People to feel something.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of jealousy because, you know, he was lower born.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that he is smart enough to ask for the right thing that is an obtainable prize from Toranaga, where he goes, well, what did he offer you? Well, he offered me your seat. And in his head, I think Yabushige knows I'm not highborn enough for this seat.
Right.
So instead he goes, I just want a bigger fief.
Mm-hmm.
I just want this fief. And Toranaga says, yeah, you do this for me and we'll do it. And I thought that was a really great exchange. And that's the kind of dialogue that I'm really, really like. My mouth is watering for this dialogue. I've been waiting for this dialogue for like a year since we got our last, House of the Dragon kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't want to compare it to Game of Thrones, but I can't help but think of Varys with his character.
Mm. Okay, I buy that. I think he might have a little finger in him, too.
Okay, yeah, fair enough.
Because he's got that, like, I could snap and betray you at any moment kind of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas Varys will betray you, but he'll do it over years.
That's true. And Varys, I do think, you know, had his biggest concern really was the kingdom, it seems, whereas Littlefinger's biggest concern himself.
Right. And I think Yabushige is closer to Littlefinger in that regard.
Yeah.
Okay, he seems very self-interested.
Yeah, it's true. But then again, maybe we will. I'm hoping that we uncover more layers with him and start to see what's driving these motivations more.
Yeah.
And I think we will. This is the kind of show that's absolutely setting that up.
Yeah. So my question is, so there's this line that Ishido has where he's basically like, you know, Yabushige told me he was on my side. Now he's going carting everyone away. Like, he betrayed me. And I'm thinking, I wonder if he did betray him or if he's playing a longer game. Like, he'll betray Torunaga at the right moment.
I was just watching a documentary, The Pigeon Tunnel, about spies. So I'm like, double agent, baby.
I genuinely couldn't tell you who he's loyal to right now.
Well, I mean, I think he's loyal to himself, definitely.
Sure.
He's probably, we'll probably see someone in his life that has his loyalty and is driving motivation.
He's the guy who says, I don't remember what show this is from, but somebody said, I'm playing both sides. That way I'm always on top.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So relatedly to Yabushige, Torunaga is really, this is like, he's shining now this episode. I think he's really doing a lot.
He's my other favorite.
Yeah. And I've seen him in other things like Westworld, but I don't know. This feels like such a breakthrough role for him.
Absolutely. Yeah.
For Western audiences, at least.
Yeah. He immediately became clear, you know, when you have the first episode, I didn't know who are the main characters yet. Obviously, the one white guy, fine. The pretty woman. But then his presence before the plot even showed it, you knew like, oh, that's the main character. And it's so crazy because listening to him in interviews, I don't know why it surprises me, but he has a completely different personality. Like, he's very lively, you know, very a little bit goofy, you know, and he's also one of the producers on the show. So very involved in bringing the show to life. Yeah. That's, I have so much respect for the actor now.
It's very cool. It's very cool to see this happen. On the character himself, he's getting pretty sneaky now, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we saw that last episode start to bud with the whole, you know, I think he knows Yabushige saved the Anjin, saved the pilot, but he's willing to overlook that because it served his own needs.
Right, exactly.
And this whole idea of when he sees that Mariko understands that he's sowing discord between the other council members by saving the pilot. It's like, as much as we want, I think Torunaga is an interesting character because he feels like the wise older man who's very kind and actually cares. Mm-hmm. But then his words to his son make it sound like he doesn't trust anybody and that he's like, he speaks like he's similar to Yabushige, but then there's moments where you see a glimmer of sort of fondness for other people.
Yeah. And that's where the actor is also so brilliant, because you just see that twinkle in his eyes that you would never allow to touch his face, but it's there. You still see it. Yeah. And so that makes it hard not to like him, even though there's no reason for us to think that he's any more kind or moral than most of the other people.
Right, right. Like, what's the difference in reality between living under his rule or Ishido's rule?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, but that is a good question. I hope they answer. I would love to see more of the common people too.
Right, right. Well, I do wonder why, you know, I understand why he saved Blackthorn from a political standpoint. But by the end of the episode, I'm like, this guy has a soft spot for Blackthorn. He likes this guy.
Yeah, well, especially by the end of the episode, yeah.
Yeah, but like, what was it that did that? Was it that he tried to defend him during the assassination attempt?
Yeah. He keeps solving his problems, you know, kept him from getting caught going through the gate, you know, the whole situation with the boat, suggesting the boat. And then I think probably the clincher was when he made it through on the other boat. And, you know, he looked at him, he's like, you know, that is a capable guy. That's not just some foreign idiot.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I feel like most of the people around Blackthorn kind of just admire his wild card nonsense. Right. They're just like, oh, that's funny. That's cool. He got away with it.
Crazy foreigners.
Yeah. Well, we got to stop calling him barbarian, though. He's got a new rank by the end of this episode.
Exactly.
What do you think about about Torunaga's relationship with his son?
I mean, because I think that's one of the where he has twinkles of fondness, but I think there's societal strictures that make him behave a certain way.
Yeah. I don't know. Because I think he would be able to put his son in charge of the army if he had to. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think there's anything against that in custom.
No, but
he genuinely, it seems like I think he's basically like, I'm going to pick the best person for the job.
Which is fair.
Or is he trying to keep Yabushige close?
Where is he also trying to protect his son in a way?
Yeah, maybe he's like, okay, well, I'm going to have somebody lead this experimental unit, and right. I don't want the person at the helm being mm-hmm. my only heir. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that is his only heir, but you know what I mean? In one of his heirs.
He's the man who gave up the top spot because he knew that it would put him in danger. So he's a strategic man. He's suspicious because he's learned that's how he survives. And it served him well, so...
Oh, I like that a lot. I like the idea of he's sort of trying to teach his son how to lay below the radar. You know, it's funny. I play Magic the Gathering. I talk about this on Second Breakfast, but, you know, I play a lot of Commander. It's 4-player, 5-player, whatever you can find. And one of the main parts of it is you gotta not be the threat until you are the threat, right? You have to lay low until you can actually do something, until you can actually go on the attack.
Yeah.
And I think that that's kind of Torunaga's philosophy with a lot of these mm-hmm. things is like, he says in the first episode, I think, like, if we go to war now, we die.
Yeah.
And so now he's like, okay, I have this wild card who can teach us something that is unexpected for Ishido's people. I'm going to try to train an army in that and see what happens.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the fresh idea often wins the war.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I can't tell you how many times I heard growing up in American history class, oh, we won the American Revolution because the Americans were willing to use guerrilla tactics and the British mm-hmm. were too formal. And mm-hmm. I don't know how propagandized that is and how oversimplified that is.
But then people say that the Romans defeated the Celts for the opposite reason. So, yeah.
It's funny. But you know what I mean? Is like there is some argument, some conventional wisdom of mm-hmm. introducing some kind of unexpected tactic can help win a war against odds.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, just the element of surprise is already a huge weapon. But then if you have a weapon that they haven't built the defenses for because they haven't thought to, they didn't know they needed to.
Right, right. Well, speaking of things that nobody has a defense to, let's talk about John Blackthorne.
That's a good impression.
Oh, thank you. Oh, fuck this place. Yeah, that's basically him. So John Blackthorne, I just wrote wild card here. I've said it like 3 times on the podcast already. But man, he kind of charmed me when he just decided to act like an idiot. The way he goes, no one's going to stop him. No mm-hmm. one's going to stop
yeah,
him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like coming to the realization, like I have to be the one to do something, which is kind of right. crazy.
I was going to say, I love the way that he did it. He's like, the honor of women.
The honor of women. Yeah. Do you not do this in your country? Yeah. Really, really funny. The grandstanding was totally believable, I think. They were like, what is this barbarian yelling about?
Yeah.
My question is, did Torunaga have a backup plan? Like if John Blackthorne exactly. didn't do something, what was going to happen?
Yeah, exactly. Like he's like, nobody's going to do something. He's just going to be like, oh, hey, oopsies. Now we all die.
Yeah. I mean, he was outnumbered there, right? Like they could have just.
Yeah. But also didn't they say that it wouldn't be just him put to the death, but also the others with him?
Yeah. Yikes.
Good thing they had a John Blackthorne, eh?
Good thing indeed. Yeah, they were. I mean, they would have found him. Like, he was going to the next card. He's like, get away from the women.
Yeah, exactly. Not this woman. She's especially ugly. Oh, I feel God. Like, yeah, there's a Monty Python sketch in there.
somewhere. It's there. Blackthorne, I will say, held his own during the fight of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
He's going up against, you know, trained warriors and Mr. Pilot over here is, I think he had a spear and he was just kind of doing his thing.
No, I mean, he's definitely proving himself. He's, proving that he does it a little bit differently, but it's effective.
Yeah, no, I like that he's not just kind of sitting there waiting for them to solve the fight problem, but he mm-hmm. is actively being like, I am serving you, Torunaga.
Yeah.
Sama, sorry. I almost forgot my Sama.
I wrote down a couple comments that people made about Blackthorne, about his cleverness, if you don't mind me reading them out. So I took one, I called it Blackthorne Propaganda Corner. And I took one from the Discord. This is Brian wrote, I've been watching Blackthorne closely. He seems to fly by the seat of his pants most of the time. However, he's smart. You see this in episode 3, even walking. He hates the sandals. You see him walking gingerly in the castle scene as he approaches Ishido's samurai with his kimono and sandals. In the book, he complains about how he misses his boots. With the boat scene, he acts and is able to use his wits. Kudos to Jarvis on this. And then my friend Heather said, like I saw somebody else say, this episode really belonged to Cosmo and Blackthorn. His willingness to embrace being the stinky freak in this new to him world brings such life into the character, but you never fully forget that this man can be dangerous. He is incredibly smart, picking up so quickly on bits of Japanese language and expectations, seeing how a situation will go and responding immediately to it. He's tenacious. He's charming. And when you combine that with his will to survive, you have a powder.
I like that a lot. I like that a lot. He's unpredictable, but yet you're right. Absolutely, Heather, is that he's competent in the weirdest way.
Yeah.
He's almost like the most competent incompetent person ever.
Yeah, exactly.
He's just running around.
Stumbles into competent. But he must have made it. So he made it around the world when, you know, the other ships failed and when so many people in his crew died.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So I also wanted to talk about his sort of frenemy relationship with Rodriguez. Yeah,
What is going on there?
What is going on? I love
it. Favorite relationship in the show.
So I love when Rodriguez finds out he's alive. He's like, he's alive? What the fuck? Like, he's just like... That was great. It
is like such a begrudging respect between them.
Yeah, and when they're both sort of racing almost with the two ships, like the way that they're looking at each other. And it's great. It's great when Blackthorn's like, look, I've done all I can. It's up to you now. Either run me off or don't, but pick one. And that was really like...
He had a life debt, you know?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. The title of Hatamoto, I actually looked this up, that Blackthorn gets at the end. This was a real title. This title, a Hatamoto, it means guardian of the banner, and it was a high-ranking samurai in direct service of the Tokugawa group in feudal Japan. And that is what Torinaga's group is based on. Okay. Because all of these, you know, it's loosely based on real history. Mm-hmm. And so I'm pretty sure all of the council members are based on real leaders of that time.
Right.
And so Torinaga's group has this specific title. It's interesting. Other ones had different named vassals. They were the Gokenin. So the Torinaga family had like their own special guardians of the banner that were like a level above the regular servants, the regular vassals. So I thought that's kind of cool that he gave him basically like the highest thing he possibly could have given him in that moment.
Abby was saying on the Discord that there's a good reason why everyone's jaws dropped at that moment. That was a huge thing.
Right, right.
Especially to someone who he's supposed to be condemning to death eventually.
Right. It's going to take a long time to translate that though.
Yeah.
But who knows? The book might fall into the sea.
Right, exactly. I have a feeling that the book's going to just disappear.
Oh, no, there was a fire. It's like True Detective. There was just a flood.
Yeah, there was a fire in the fire pit and the book just fell into it.
That's, you know, we're going to put that in the safety regulations. Don't translate next to a fire.
Yeah. But I mean, isn't it also when they translated, then he has records of... where all of these Spanish outposts are. I mean, sorry, Portuguese outposts.
Yes, he does. He does. So that's another part. And I think he can sort of point them to that. Maybe he says, okay, well, these pages are good. Those pages, I don't know, they got lost somewhere.
Yeah.
I'm sure, honestly, they'll figure something out. This is the protagonist of the series. He's not dying in episode 4 or whatever.
Well, hey, Ned Stark. May he rest
that's
in
fair.
Peace.
That's fair. Man, that really was a game-changing moment in that
Absolutely.
Show. And where do we end up? Anyway, I just want to say about training Torinaga's army. Did you like when, Torinaga first asks Blackthorn to train the army? And he's like, well, I'm just a pilot. And then he's like, wait, this is my ticket to not die.
Right.
Yes, I can train them. And Mariko only... I think translates the second part. Like she doesn't, express his doubt.
Right. First. It's been very interesting to watch how the characters like her and the Portuguese priest and stuff, how they translate for these characters, because there's a lot of politics wrapped up in the words that they choose to translate or not.
Yeah, and what they add to it too. I'll get to that in Mariko's section too. But for now, I wanted to mention his little moment of, you know what? I'm going to think better of this, and I'm not going to undersell myself. I am the king of all combat. And then the diving and racing at the end.
That was so charming. That was just such an uplifting way to end the episode.
What do you think was the point of the dive? Was it just like, how high, if when I say jump, you say how high kind of thing?
I think it was a mixture of things. I think there was an element of like showing control, but also I think he was genuinely wanting to learn and he was going to make sure that he had thoroughly studied the procedure before he made a fool of himself.
Interesting. Well, I like that. Do you think maybe we could take a quick break? I don't know why I'm asking you. We're taking a break. When we get back, we're going to hear David's hot take thoughts, which I forgot to play in the intro. And then we'll move on to Mariko. And we're back. So in the intro, David, out of the kindness of his heart, on his COVID bed, he decided to record us a couple messages. One of them has his hot takes for the episode, so we're going to listen to that here.
Hey, John and Alicia, just wanted to send in my quick thoughts on the episode. Overall, I thought it was a good episode, but something was a little different in this, and I think it's thrown my enjoyment off just a little bit. Not sure if I can put my fingers right on it. Maybe it was the fast, slow tempo changes. The boat chase and the negotiation just kind of felt a little off relative to the rest of the episode. The diving and the swimming was kind of weird, but I totally get what it's about for the purposes of the story. There's certainly some not great CGI, but whatever about that. So I thought it was a really good episode 3 for the series. Lots of good character building moments. World building moments, really moves the story forward in a number of ways. I finished watching the episode 2 of the 1980 miniseries. And remember, these are like 2 and 3 hour long, episodes themselves. So it's really interesting to see where the two overlap and where they diverge. Regardless of where they do that, they're still hitting all the major beats. And they're doing that on the FX series while at the same time recentering the story. And I really think that this is passing the shippy test in a nice way, so that we're shifting our gaze and we're a more balanced, centered gaze. But at the same time, the story is absolutely hitting those plot points, which must be coming from the book. And so I think if all three of these are weaving together in this way, it's a really great job on the script that they've done. That's pretty impressive. I think in terms of adding to the conversation about what the show is bringing forward sort of philosophically, I think we added something interesting here, which is individualism versus service to the greater good, where Blackthorn, is saying, you know, oh, I'm just living for myself, where he's discovering a society where people live within a kind of hierarchy, even though he comes from one of those in the sense of loyalty to royal families and fief, you know, lords that, you know, own your land, that kind of stuff. Anyway, I think it's an interesting examination of those social structures. I thought what was interesting too, along with that, is these questions of fate and destiny. So we add that into the conversation. But then all at the same time, we get this very interesting line from Toranaga to his son: in the game of friends and enemies, you only have yourself.
Well, thanks, David, for calling in, I guess. It's weird to hear you as a feedbacker instead of a full podcaster, but we'll have you back soon. What do you think about David's takes? I think he was more lukewarm about the episode than both of us.
I can see why, because one thing is that I do feel like it was a slighter episode, but I was okay with that because it's like a transitional episode, and it's the first two episodes, like, we're establishing this world, heavy hitters. And now this one is kind of like, okay, let's just linger in a little while, get to know the landscape. But also another thing, I brought this up with David and he agreed that there's a certain Dune effect going on right now where we just saw this movie that we think is like the greatest thing and everything else is slightly dulled in comparison. But that effect will wear off.
Well, I haven't seen Dune, so I can't be affected by that just yet. But I could see that. I get it. Sometimes you just, like, you know, you play a really good video game or you read a really good book and the next thing that you read is just not going to be good. Because you're too busy comparing it.
I think this wasn't supposed to. There's a certain, I won't, no Dune spoilers, but I'll say there's a certain scene with a character and a worm. And I was thinking about that scene during the whole ship scene. And I was like, if I hadn't just seen that, I'd be more excited about the ship scene. But I'm like, but it's not supposed to be the same level of stakes at this point.
Right,
per se.
Right.
You know, this is a different, don't compare.
Yeah. As you know, I've read The Wheel of Time as of you, and I feel like hanging out with characters that I like is something that it appeals to me. And I think that this episode does a lot of that. And that's fine.
This episode was a good hang for sure.
Yeah.
And that's one reason why I like it. Yeah.
And I really feel like I'm getting to know. It was the same thing in True Detective. I know some people really like the opening episodes better, but I was saying I was more into it episodes three and on because that was where I started to get to know the characters. And for me, characters are the heart of the stories. And I want to care about the characters before I can care about anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I agree with that take. I still really need to watch True Detective.
It was pretty good. I'm not, now that I've watched Shogun, I don't think True Detective's going on my top 10 list.
Oh, see? You got the dulling of the shine effect.
We'll see. We'll see. I mean, Shogun's really good. Again, we're on episode 3 of 10.
So yeah, absolutely. We're just warming up.
We could have a Game of Thrones situation where it plummets, but I hope not. I hope it's really good to the end.
I hate the finale less. I just think, I knew that was George R. R. Martin's intention. They just got there too quickly. And I think if we have these writers here, and now, of course, it's based on a finished novel, too. So you can't underestimate that. It knows where it's going. So, and it'll take the proper pacing.
I will forever be salty about the ending of Game of Thrones.
That's fair.
However, we're not
talking
about Game
about
of Thrones.
That's how I feel about The 100.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Well, anyway, back to Shogun. We've got to talk about Mariko. So poor Buntaro, like, how do we feel here?
I think it's a complicated relationship because just her face was what captivated me most during his whole I'm going to be the hero moment. Because you couldn't quite read. And I don't think she really knew if she's like, oh, I'm losing him. Is that good? Is that bad? I'm losing a protector in a way, but also I'm losing someone who I didn't have a good relationship with, but he is my husband. And all of these complicated feelings were in her look.
Right. I certainly think it was a loveless marriage. I mean, even her describing Buntaro to Blackthorn earlier, it just felt like she was reciting like generic, like he's a good guy. You know, it's just a generic, he's a nice guy kind of thing. Instead of, oh, I really love him. When we met, it was magical. This, that, you know, like you can tell when someone's really enamored with somebody that they're talking about.
No, she's not into
and
it.
And she just wasn't.
No.
She lit up, though, when she was asking and telling about kids. She loves her kids. And she wanted to hear about his.
Yeah. And Buntaro was, you know, reprimanding her for being too affectionate with her son. So that's definitely going to put a wedge between them even more.
Right. Buntaro, poor kind of Buntaro.
Do you think like he might have been taken prisoner and we'll see him again, something like that?
No.
No? You think that's it?
I think he's dead. Okay. His narrative purpose has ended.
Unless he pops up to mess things up later.
Yeah, with Blackthorn and Mariko are having their six children.
Right.
Yeah. They are absolutely signaling that, right? Like they are absolutely signaling
I was gonna bring it
that
up
they
too.
Like each other, that they are, you know, people are shipping them. And of course, now she's a widow. So she's, how long does Blackthorn have to wait before he asks if she's single?
Before he asks about the pillowing.
Yeah, about pillowing again. Oh man. So I didn't write this in the outline, but I really wanted to talk about the scene where They have the doctor there, and she explains pillowing, and then she goes, mm-hmm. Would you prefer a male companion instead? She adds that.
Yeah.
Where the hell am I? Just
well, apparently in the book, he was even more like, you know, offended by that, but I guess they toned it down.
I actually did a deep dive on homosexuality in Japan and acceptance of it. It sounds like, from what I read on Wikipedia, which is, when I say a deep dive, I mean I read Wikipedia. Right. It sounds like it was actually pretty accepted until the Meiji era. So until like the late 1800s, it was pretty accepted. Now, Japan has issues. Like, Japan does not currently allow same-sex marriage or civil union. You can get, like, a certificate in certain cities, in certain, you know, like in Shibuya and things like that. But it's an issue today, still for LGBTQ individuals. Until, like, the late 1800s, it was not a big issue, which is super interesting. There was sort of an importing of Western homophobia into Japan.
Well, I think, I mean, I'm of the opinion that homophobia is kind of something you have to learn, because it is just a normal thing that happens amongst, you know, all animals, basically humans. Just you kind of have to learn to think it's weird. Like for instance, we think it's weird if in America, if men wear skirts, but in Scotland, that's, you know, kilts are tradition.
That's just Tuesday.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's interesting because, you know, obviously at this time, England and Amsterdam are still not very accepting of homosexuality. But Blackthorne's coming over here and he's like, where the hell am I? When she goes, oh, do you want a man? Like, she just asks casually, right? Oh, do you prefer a man?
Yeah, but it is also, for instance, a lot of like sexism and a lot of prejudices were learned from the Romans, who were learned it from the Christians, who, you know. It's just people passing on these prejudices.
Yeah. Super interesting stuff. The history of prejudice. But that was a funny conversation, though, when he's just like, and calling him a warlock, too. That was really good. If he's not a warlock, he's surely a pimp.
See, he gets all the best lines.
He does get all the best lines. He's the one who makes me laugh the most. Also, like, because it's in English, I can tell the way he's inflecting it, which makes it funnier. True. Whereas in Japanese, first of all, has very, it's much flatter than English. Mm-hmm. Like, it's very like, which is intentional. That's the style of
speech. Yeah, that's not the emotional. Yeah.
But it's harder for me to understand humor in that, right? Other than just reading the lines.
Yeah, I think, so Abby was bringing up about the poetry in the Japanese that isn't quite translating. And in the second episode of the FX podcast, they talked about how difficult it is to translate from the Japanese into the English. So I wish I knew some Japanese, because...
Wouldn't that be great?
It would be great. If I could just download languages, my head matrix style.
Yep, for sure. I'm still wondering what's going on with that death 14 years ago. I want to know more of her history that Torunaga brought up. And I'm really curious if Blackthorne will successfully make her distrust the church. Because she's smart.
Yeah.
She's really smart. Yeah. And I think she kind of does distrust the church already. I mean, I think she feels like a lot of religious people, where they're like, well, I believe in the religion. I'm not a fan of the institution. I think a lot of people in recent memory have felt that way. And it seems like Mariko might be there already.
Well, I mean, but that's literally what a Protestant is. So I think I see him swaying her over to, like, you know, it's a different kind of Christian, but without the foibles of the Catholic kind, of the papists, as he called them.
Always a good day when you can use the word foibles.
It's interesting because obviously when it comes to the Dutch versus the Portuguese, I know how that ends, but it's still very interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So let's go on to the council. I just wanted to sort of talk about the political movements in this episode. So we've got Torunaga resigning at the end, with Hiramatsu reminding the council that they need 5 votes to impeach him. So automatically buying himself time. That's all he's doing there, right? Because they'll get a 5th member. They just got to figure it out. Very smart to buy himself time so they can't just go hunt him down right now in Edo.
Yeah.
Or in the fishing village that they're in.
Well, yeah. And to get out of there, obviously.
Yeah. But I mean, they wouldn't have let him leave even if he resigned, right? So
exactly.
It's good that he got out. So Torunaga is now playing the council from two sides, right? He's created friction just by saving the pilot, saving the engine. But he also is trying to get the church now to turn Ono and Kiyama to his side.
Right.
Which is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And by putting the church there, do you think Torunaga is going to try to convert to Christianity, even if just in name?
I do think that that's where this is going. Just also, I think Blackthorne's going to be an accidental missionary. You know, that's not his intention at all. But for political reasons and also for his clearly budding romance with Mariko, he's going to wind up representing the Protestant theology. And
he's the only one around, so somebody's got to do it, right? unless we can get back to that pastor from the priest from the prison.
Right. And wasn't the guy who got beheaded in the first episode, wasn't he a priest too?
Oh, maybe.
Anyway, he's not helping anybody.
No, he's not. No, he's not. I didn't mention it before, but Torunaga did what a masterful negotiation with the Portuguese there, where, you know, the Portuguese were ready to just sail off and consequences be damned. And he's like, I will give you political cover. I guess his last act as does he still retain that ambassadorship, really? Does he retain the foreign affairs if he's not on the council anymore?
I don't know. I mean, I guess he's just such a powerful figure that he can just get away with saying stuff like that. But then it's also if they're going after him anyway, then who cares?
Right. And then he goes, OK, well, that's not enough. I also need you to go and turn two of the council members
right
to my side. They say, OK, but we want Blackthorne.
Yeah.
And he's like, sure. But then Blackthorne just goes, fuck this, and sails off.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if he actually thought that he was giving him up or if he had a suspicion that Blackthorne would find his own way through.
Yeah, I don't know. Because, again, he did have a fondness for him. But I think at that point, he would have been willing to give him up if he had to.
Yeah.
Like, he'd rather for sure have his head than Blackthorne. So I think he gave Blackthorne an opportunity by having him on the other boat. But that's about it.
Yeah, exactly. I guess he was willing to roll the dice there. It was a risk he was willing to take.
Right. How do you say Matt's thing?
Doviandi se tovia sagan.
It's time to roll the dice. If you're not a Wheel of Time fan, become one. All right. So why don't we talk about our favorite moments? Shall we bring David back in to give his?
Absolutely.
So I wanted to shout out really quick what I thought was the best scene in the episode, and that was when Torunaga was giving respect to Buntaro. It felt really earned and it felt really emotional. And I thought both of the actors did an excellent job of communicating the sacrifice play and the respect and the honor that was given between the two of them. But I think it's pretty important that we recognize that we didn't see him die on screen. So I'm assuming that there's going to be more to come for Buntaro.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, one other thing, earlier on in the episode, we got to see a lingering shot of Tadayoshi's samurai swords. Remember, he was the guy who ended his line. There's a long lingering shot on his swords, and I think that is going to clue us into something. I think for the Dune heads, if I said the word Jamis, you know, folks might get a clue on that. All right. Thanks, and we'll talk to you soon.
Feel better, David, even though you're not here. I'll tell you if you listen to the podcast later. Yeah, I thought that was a cool scene selection, too. Any favorite scenes for you, Alicia?
I mean, we did kind of mention them, but the ones that I first think of is just that look that Mariko gives Buntaro when he's standing on the dock. And, you know, you can just see all the conflicting thoughts running through her head. And yeah, the other one is definitely Blackthorne defending the honor of women.
super good. I kind of mentioned before too, but I really loved the sort of budding bromance between Rodriguez and Blackthorne.
Yeah.
And I really liked the diving scene. It was very wholesome.
Yeah, I was gonna bring
it was a really
up
great
too.
Close to the episode.
Yeah, absolutely. It was just the nice, because, you know, sometimes you need, I remember Marilyn talking about this, about the need for downtime in between the harrowing moments, and this was just a moment of respite.
Right. You need to go to Farmer Maggot's
right.
mushroom patch in between, or Tom Bombadil's house, right?
Right, exactly.
You need somebody. that's about it for the episode. Any other thoughts before we go to listener feedback?
No, I'm just, I'm strapped in. I'm really excited to see where this season goes. Obviously, it's doing quite well. So I wonder, yeah, how far this series is going to go into the books.
Yeah, me too, for sure. All right, so we've got some listener feedback, Alicia. If people want to write in or send in a voicemail, they can go to thelorehounds.com, go to the contact form page and send in a contact form or a voicemail. You could also send an email to shogun@thelorehounds.com or go to our Discord server and you can get all that in the show notes. We already did David's voicemails, but Abby also sent in a voicemail. So let's hear that now.
It's my first time using the voicemail. Hello, I'm Abby. I apologize for my strong Eastern European accent, but I hear you also struggle with the Japanese. Hence, this message is not about a particular episode, rather a linguistic input. Not to be that person, but we have 10 episodes with some names and expressions popping up frequently. So it would be good if we get some of these pronounced correctly. I'm aware that I'm in the privileged position of understanding both languages and spoken on screen and not relying exclusively on subtitles. But well, firstly, the title, Shogun. It's not split into sho and guns. It's made up of two kanji characters, meaning leader and army, hence translated in English as general. But of course, this is a bit reductive, as shogun is in fact a shortened version of seitai shogun, and in a sense, a general of generals, and the position meaning the government, when being something like a prime minister slash dictator of the country. So, ladies and gentlemen, repeat after me. Shogun.
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 Next one is Toranaga. 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 And we sure don't want to earn his disapproval. We saw what happens. One step out of line and you apologize by seppuku. Also, the lady Mariko will be addressed going forward as Mariko-sama, as she herself demanded, Mariko-sama.
Mariko-sama.
Thank you. Well, looking forward to hearing your thoughts about the show, and I hope I can contribute with perspective of a foreigner immersed in the culture, all by the modern version for 27 years. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Hi, Abisama. Thank you very much for that. Always good to learn the pronunciation. I know David and I were like debating it in the first episode, so I really, really appreciate that. I think it's tricky because when you learn a foreign language in the US, which we do very poorly, they generally put you into a romantic language like Spanish or Italian or French. And I know with like at least Spanish, they're like, always do the second syllable unless there's an accent. You know, you want to emphasize right. that. And in Japanese, it's supposed to be very even or, you know, shogun. Like it's one sort of flowing thing. It's so different to wrap your head around that. So I appreciate you spelling some of them out for me.
Yeah, no, it's super interesting also to hear about the linguistics, the meanings of these words.
Yes, for sure. Shogun sounds like a pretty cool title to have over here.
Yeah. And we apologize for not giving Mariko-sama the proper respect this episode.
It's true. It's true. We'll do better. I promise. So Nancy M. wrote in. Nancy M., a lore master, provides us a mini history lesson.
Ooh.
I listened to episode 1 and 2 podcast this morning, and David and John asked for a deep dive on Macau. As my parents were born in Portugal, I thought I would take this on. Macau started as a port of refuge, fresh water, and food for merchant sailors until it was settled by refugees fleeing the Mongol invaders in 1277. In the 15th century, the powerful Turkish Empire blocked the overland route to the east. This was the catalyst for Portuguese expeditions to find a sea route to India. The Portuguese reached China in 1513. In 1517, Portugal's King Manuel I commissioned a diplomatic and trade mission to Guangzhou. I hope that I pronounced that remotely right. The mission was rejected by the Chinese Ming court, one reason being reports of misbehavior by the Portuguese elsewhere in China. In 1521 and 1522, several more Portuguese ships were driven away by the now hostile Ming authorities. Good relations resumed in the 1940s when the Portuguese helped China eliminate coastal pirates and the Ming court finally gave consent for a permanent and official Portuguese trade base at Macau. Okay, so we learned how we got to Macau, right, with the Portuguese. Yeah. So that's a good start. Any thoughts on that, Alicia, before I move on?
My knowledge of this era is very Dutch focused. So all of this back stuff before the Dutch come in is kind of new to me, or I haven't really like learned much about it. So it's super interesting.
Well, in come the Dutch. The Guangzhou Macau Nagasaki route was particularly profitable because the Portuguese acted as middlemen, shipping Chinese silks to Japan and Japanese silver to China, pocketing huge markups in the process. This already lucrative trade became even more so when Chinese officials handed Macau's Portuguese traders a monopoly by banning direct trade with Japan in 1547. Yikes! Mm-hmm. Macau's golden age coincided with the union of the Spanish and Portuguese crowns. Between 1580 and 1640, King Philip II of Spain was encouraged to not harm the status quo, to allow trade to continue between Portuguese Macau and Spanish Manila, and to not interfere with Portuguese trade with China. The union of Portugal and Spain meant that the Portuguese colonies became targets for England and the Netherlands. The English had ambitions to set up trading posts in East Asia. The Netherlands was embroiled at the time in a lengthy struggle for its independence from Spain. After the Dutch East India Company was founded in 1602, the Dutch unsuccessfully attacked Macau several times, culminating in a full-scale invasion attempt in 1622 when 800 attackers were successfully repelled by 150 Macanese and Portuguese defenders with a large number of African slaves. The Jesuits, who feared the Protestant Dutch, were instrumental in helping to defend Macau.
And it's interesting because all of these activities led to the Golden Age in the Netherlands.
That is interesting. The attempted Dutch invasion was seen as a threat to their epic missionary activities in Asia. As well as being an important trading post, Macau was the center of activity for Catholic missionaries, as it was seen as a gateway for the conversion of the vast populations of China and Japan. Jesuits had first arrived in the 1560s and built the first church, St. Lazarus. The Jesuits were followed by Dominicans, Franciscans, and Augustinians in the 1580s.
Woo! What's from the Dutch perspective, what we're always taught is that, spoilers for history, but that the Portuguese end up losing out the trade with Japan to the Dutch because the Dutch were less interested in converting them. They were like, we're here to trade. And of course, they eventually say, you can only trade from this one island here. But then the Dutch became their only way of trading with the outside world instead of the Portuguese, because they said, we just want to take our goods and go. So it's interesting that the whole Protestant religion is being used as a tool in the show.
Yeah. Yeah, that is cool. I mean, It sort of sounds like, from your perspective, Alicia, learning it in Amsterdam, that it was more of a secular versus religious thing rather than a Catholic versus Protestant thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that that's a factor. And of course, people wouldn't call themselves secular because it was people got excommunicated but they were just less. Because the Netherlands is always, Amsterdam especially, is always isolated from the big royal courts and the big churches. And they had limited influences of those kinds. Mm-hmm. So it was just kind of farmers and fishermen who banded together and were very practical. Like, how do we survive? How do we get water off our land? How do we, get more money for our country?
Interesting. Well, thanks, Nancy M., for that history deep dive. It was a very impressive report here. So that's really helpful to know.
I learned a lot. Thank you.
So Lorehound Kyle M. writes in about the next big thing. It feels like everyone has been looking for the next Game of Thrones forever. Television executives, yes, of course, because any of them would run over a bunny rabbit with their BMW for that kind of career-making hit that carries a network for a decade. But also, like everyone, It's fun to have a show that breaks out of its little niche bubble to become a thing that permeates the culture. It's been a while since we had one of those. Succession got most of the way there, but it's over now. The Walking Dead is on its eighth spinoff about. The Stranger Things kids are old enough to rent cars. The Yellowstone has the ratings, but does not have the juice. It's been weird. You can talk about TV with 10 different people and realize none of you watch a single show in common. It makes it all more isolating and lonely than something this fun should be. Agreed. Agreed.
Yeah, I miss the old, like, water cooler talk days.
Yeah, appointment television kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that's why so many people are so excited about Shogun. I'm practicing my Abby pronunciation.
Right.
Shogun. It debuted to a slew of stellar reviews that had a bunch of Game of Thrones comparisons, which are fair. There are no dragons or mystical elements, fine by me, but a lot of the other boxes are checked. Big, sweeping, historical epic, check. Huge cast and crew, full of interesting characters. Whip-ass action scenes, check, check. Mostly, though, the biggie is that there was a bunch of money and effort thrown at this sucker that is all right there on the screen. It looks incredible in addition to being compelling. We're a little over 2 hours in, and there are already characters I love and despise, and one of them almost died in a shipwreck during a storm with waves as big as my apartment complex. This is the good stuff, people. Yeah, let's stop there for a second. This is the good stuff. Wouldn't you say, Alicia?
No, I agree. I think it's bringing conversation together, and it's just looking, it's undeniable quality.
I think the biggest hurdle here is just the scope. The original novel by James Clavell came out 50 years ago. There are a number of warring factions and rivalries in Japan, in addition to some Catholic versus Protestant tension that swept over from Europe. It can be a little daunting at the outset to figure out who's who and who is doing what. Google is helpful here, as is the guide FX created as a companion. I knew nothing about any of this, and I was caught up in about 15 minutes. I look forward to the full development of David's journal as well. Yes, definitely. David and the Dunedain have been working on the ship's rudder for everyone to look at if you're a patron. So if you are a patron or you want to sign up for it or the Supercast, we'll get you the links to the guide, the show guide. Kyle finishes up. So yeah, I hope this sucker takes off. It would be fun to have a big communal experience around a show, a fun show that kicks ass again. Let's all get way into samurais this spring. Maybe I'll buy a sword. Maybe we all should. I don't know. Could go a lot of ways here. Thanks, KM.
I always wanted a katana.
You know, when I first started dating my wife and we first moved in together, my dad had an apartment on the other side of his house that was like closed off. So that was our first apartment together.
Mm-hmm.
And he walked in to visit one day and he saw my wife's sword on the wall. And he said, "Whose sword is this?" And I said, that's my wife's name. And he goes, "Wow, cool." And so I've always admired that about my wife, that she's collected swords where I have not. She's the sword collector.
Now they are all
safely away because of children.
Yeah. Random story, but so Hjalti, who's those of you who listen to the Oscar podcast heard me talk to him about animated shorts. He's from Iceland, and his sister once tried to bring a Viking sword back from him. And apparently there's a rule at Iceland that you can't have any like weapons or even like replica weapons like that. And they took it from her at the airport. And so they just let her take a picture with it. And she's like crying.
Wow. That's crazy. That's sad.
Yeah.
Matt E closes us out. Our old pal, Matt E, says, "I can forgive John's Shogun versus Tycho misstep, but I hear just a little too much of Ted Lasso's Roy in his Jon Snow. I just can't unhear it. So glad you guys are doing Shogun." One thing I wonder is whether Mariko and her status/relationships with Toranaga or her husband is portrayed similarly in the reboot versus the original miniseries or book. Her only other smart person in the room reveal in episode 2 felt very 21st century. If original, it feels very progressive. Matt E. I first want to defend my impression of John Blackthorne, because John Blackthorne, he's everyone's full of shit around me, and they just want everything from me.
I think that's more John Blackthorne than Roy.
I'm trying. But thank you for the feedback, Maddie.
But I don't think he sounds like Jon Snow either, so.
No, I meant more the vibe, right? The, I don't want that. I don't want it.
he knows nothing.
What did you think about this take on Mariko? Do you think, I don't know anything about the miniseries, and I haven't gotten up to her in the book.
No, I am curious, but is she a stronger character in the show than she is in the book? I don't know. Have you gotten to spend time with her in the book yet?
I have not at all, so I couldn't say.
Okay.
Good question. I'll get back to you, Matt. Mm. I could see it being an addition for the new show, but I don't know. It felt very natural to me, too.
It's not like an invention of the modern age to have strong women. It's just that they had to be more political about it and maneuver in specific ways. And that's exactly what makes her character so interesting, is she is so good at playing the role, but still, you know, she's still learning things, like she's learning languages and learning more about the world. She's satisfying her curiosity in ways that are, that fit within her, what she's allowed.
Right. I think if you notice, she hasn't volunteered for anything. She's just been pulled in because of her skills. She has a personality. You know, she chose to convert to Catholicism, and she has this, you know, this speech to, I forgot her name, but the soon-to-be widowed woman when her husband and son are about to die. And she clearly is very intelligent and thoughtful and empathetic. I think that with the politics, she is playing it smartly, and she's not overstepping at all anywhere. She's just waiting for Toranaga to call on her, but she's right at the ready when he does.
And also, you know, we alluded to earlier, the way she translates is also how she exerts her subtle influence on the situation.
Right. Right. Well, thank you, Maddie. And thank you, everyone, for writing in. If I missed anybody, I'm sorry. I had to rush to do feedback because we're running by the seat of our pants this week. David's gone.
David, we miss
we miss David, but David will be back soon. Let's talk quickly, Alicia, about what's going on the network. You've got some stuff cooking. Tell us about it.
So stay tuned next month for a Star Wars related announcement, but in the meantime, and we'll shift dust, you know, we're prepping for Beacon 23 episode, season 2 is coming in April, and we're filmed the two seasons back, so
that's crazy.
Yeah, and I think it's smart of them to do that. You know, like, let's not the people who were into the show. Like, let's piggyback on that and give them more, and maybe their marketing is terrible. I hope that they do better this time around. But then again, it's month away, and we've heard almost
and nothing. It's on MGM Plus, which is the strangest decision. Who ever heard of that before Beacon 23?
Well, but that's why MGM Plus, it was originally going to be on another network, but then they, like, Spectrum Originals stopped making, they shut down, so it got sold, and so MGM rescued it.
Interesting.
And a couple other shows, yeah. But yeah, and then we're diving back into Dune. So we're going through with the book and all of the adaptations, and then through the new movies and on to eventually the next book, you know, help you prep for part 3, which I'm pretty sure is coming.
Anthony on the Properly Howard feed is cooking up something. I don't know if he's at liberty to speak about it or me at liberty to speak about it yet, but I think things are coming on that feed. So stay subscribed over there. I know Marilyn, though, just launched her new feed, Rings and Rituals. She's talking with Dr. Sarah Brown, who is a professor of Tolkienology and did her PhD in Tolkien. And Marilyn is, of course, our favorite Tolkien scholar, as we say repeatedly. And they're talking about all the rituals within the Rings of Power. So it's really great. I listened to the first episode already, and I couldn't stop. I couldn't put it down. I was waiting to listen to it till everyone had it. And I'm glad I did, because it was really enjoyable. And I got to keep up with the community in real time. So definitely check that out. That's in the show notes as well. We've got some stuff cooking with Fallout, of course. I think Aaron Kay from our Discord is going to be launching a Fallout feed soon, but stay tuned for that. We'll have more details about that soon.
The trailers look so good.
Yeah, they do look good. I've never been a big Fallout guy, so I'm actually kind of glad that Aaron reached out to us to cover it. I don't know if I don't know if David and I are covering it. We haven't decided yet.
I have never played the games. Of course, I'm well aware of them. People make also comparisons with Silo, which is kind of how I'm most aware of them. Just watching the trailer, I think this is going to be one of the strongest shows of the year.
I hope so. I hope so. I mean, I've not gotten into the games that much, but I think more from a gameplay perspective than a story perspective. So hopefully removing the gameplay will make me like it better. Okay. Other things that we have going on the network, of course, Weekly Shogun. Keep writing in for that. We've got a new Silmarillion story is coming. I promise it's coming eventually. Earthsea, we're recording Dragonfly soon, so you still have a couple days to write in for that.
We just wrapped up the Oscars prep series.
Oscars prep series. We made an exception to our rule, Alicia, where David and I have had a longstanding rule to not put anything on this feed without one of us, but COVID has defeated that rule. So I'm excited to listen to it. I'm going to listen to it.
Jean and I flying solo.
I'm sure it was great.
Burn the house down. No.
What did you talk about on it? Like what was the...
So this was part three. So this one was focusing on, we're calling them the Blockbuster Awards, or, you know, they're called the Technical Awards. So all of the visual and audio awards and, you know, VFX. So it happens to be a bunch of movies that Jean, David and I have talked about together on this feed, plus all the best picture movies that we talked about. And, you know, had some interviews with Dead Eye Jedi Bob about the sound category, with Abby about Poor Things. Yeah, and we had some more voicemails from the community and beyond.
Cool.
Including Adrian, he should have an career in ASMR. So if you want to know what I'm talking about, then check that episode out.
Cool. Yeah, can't wait to listen to that. Just a couple other quick plugs. I know that we are going to do something on Dune. We don't know exactly what yet, but we're working on plans for that. When David's healed up, we'll get that done. So plenty of stuff coming. Want to talk about our Patreon quick. If you want to support us, if you want to keep us moving, keep us able to, you know, support creators who work with us and to keep our Zencaster subscription paid and keep the website online, you can join our Patreon for as little as $3 a month. You get early and ad-free episodes of our podcast. You get the warm, fuzzy feeling of helping us stay afloat. And now you get these nice show guides. I don't know if we're always going to do them for every show, but we at least have them for two shows now, for True Detective and Shogun. So if you don't know what it is, you go to Notion and you will have tabs that you can click on that'll tell you all the character names, tell you some background about them. David's been putting in some details about the world in there. And then the Dunedain, our moderators, have been helping him out with it. And so as a community project, people can write in with stuff to add to it too, which is pretty cool. And it's a good time. We have to just do our thank yous before we head out. So I want to thank our Discord server boosters quickly. That's Opus and the Machine, Gnarls, Aaron K, Tiller the Thriller, and Dork of the Ninjas. Those are just people who, out of their own free will, without us asking, just boosted our Discord server so that we could have a few extra features on our Discord. The Lore Masters, who we thank every episode, are our top tier patrons. They get a shout out as part of their benefits, and they are Samartian, Mark H, Michael G, Michelle E, David W, Brian P, Nick W, SC, Peter OH, Bettina W, Adam S, Nancy M, Duve 71, Brian 8063, Frederick H, Sarah L, Gareth C, Eric F, Matthew M, Sarah M, DJ Miwa, Andra B, Kwang Yu, Dead Eye Jedi Bob, Nathan T, Alex V, Aaron T, Sub Zero, Aaron K, Dally V21, Gnarls, and Adrian, who is always going to be last because he has asked for that. I love when people give us funny things to say with their names on the Lore Master thing. It keeps it light.
I agree.
Alicia, thank you for being with me. Thank you for everyone listening. Thanks for the patrons for supporting. And
thank you for letting me talk about this show.
Oh, no, I'm happy to have you. I hope we can have you again before the end of the season.
Awesome.
See you soon. The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.